Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
Artificial intelligence, will it service or control us?
Behave yourself, Artu. He asked you a question.
Robots that can think and feel.
I think, Sebastian. Therefore I am.
Blurring the boundaries between man and machine.
Lieutenant Desora just gave me what could be considered a very passionate kiss in the torpedo bay.
Our guest, Marvin Minsky from MIT.
When Philosophy Talk continues after the news.
I'll be back.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, artificial intelligence, and we'll tackle this subject in three parts. First, we'll look at the vision of AI, its most optimistic vision for itself. Then we'll examine the current state and realities of AI. And next, we'll wrap up the program with a discussion of the moral dilemmas that we believe will be raised as AI advances and gets better.
Well, Ken, let's start with a definition of intelligence. And here's one I'll put out. So you've got a system, and intelligence, a system is intelligent if it has the capacity to pick up information, to perform some kind of actions in pursuit of some goal or another, and to alter the actions it takes in response to the information it picks up. Anything that does that, I think, has some intelligence.
Well, that sounds reasonable to me. You know, I wonder, though, about the artificial in artificial intelligence. If your thing can do that, wouldn't it be really intelligent? We might call it synthesized intelligence, but why artificial?
Well, you should have been there when the term was invented, Ken, but we're probably going to have to stick with it, but I think you've got a good point here. But note that on this definition of intelligence, a thing could be intelligent, a robot, an android, the box on your table, on your desk. It could be intelligent even if it was really intelligent in a very different way for very different reasons than humans. It might not have sensation, it might not be conscious, it might not have its own goals, but just those that are programmed into it might have no emotions.
So you think of human intelligence as a complicated package, and you don't have to have all those elements of the package that count as intelligent. That sounds right to me. Think of, like, flying. Airplanes fly, dirigibles fly, birds fly. Hot air balloons fly, but they have all different kinds of capacities and they work differently, even though they share this one property of being able to fly.
And I think this point points to a major divide in AI research, that is artificial intelligence research. On the one hand, in cognitive science, psychology, people are really interested in using computers to help us understand how humans do things. So they want intelligence, but they want intelligence arrived at on the same basic principles and using the same basic processes that humans use.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the AI as cognitive science, it's an important part of cognitive science. You try to come up with computational models, AI models of how the mind actually works, and you think that reveals something about the mind. But there's also AI as engineering, and that's a big deal, right? And I think a lot of AI is about engineering. You just want useful tools that have some ingredients of intelligence, whether it's the same as human intelligence or not. Who cares? You care about the AI as a tool for achieving all kinds of purposes.
You know, my old friend Georg Kreisel used to define AI in terms of a riddle. He said, what's the difference between computer science and artificial intelligence? Computer science makes computers do well what humans do poorly. AI does the opposite.
Wait a minute, see if I get... Oh, I see what you mean. So, like, human beings can't do calculus very quickly. Computers can do that really easily. But human beings can engage in an ordinary conversation or walk and chew gum or repair a car without breaking it. And it's hard to get robots and computers to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, of course, Kreisel's definition was characteristically a little bit barbed. I don't think AI people are trying to make computers that do poorly what humans do well, or trying to make computers that do what humans do well even better than humans.
Right, and our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Cornelli, went to a robotics lab in which they're trying to do that, just that kind of thing. She files this report.
The first thing you see when you walk into the robotics lab is a big piece of paper where someone has written, "Welcome to the AI lab," and drawn a picture of the Stanford seal. Well, not exactly someone. The words are bubble letter versions of Times New Roman, and the seal is perfectly round. A robot drew this sign with a permanent marker, the same way a human would.
Our focus is in human-friendly robot systems.
Usama Khatib is a lead researcher here.
The question is, what is this robot for? That is, if we think that we need a robot to interact with us, if we need a robot to help and assist a worker, to assist an elderly to walk, well, then we need a robot that is compatible with the human.
In today's world, robots are primarily used in manufacturing, but these heavy robotic devices would be destructive in a human environment. In 1997, Honda created a robot called Asimo, which could walk. Khatib says even that model wouldn't be very useful to people.
These robots are incapable of touching the environment. And if they touch the environment, they immediately receive reaction forces and they will tip over. So our contribution here is really on making robot capable of doing that interaction, having a robot capable of sitting on a chair, coming to a desk and writing something or manipulating different objects, having a robot capable of really watching your car. It requires the robot to touch and control the contact forces without breaking the windows or breaking any object.
The key to that is haptics, the technology that gives robots a sense of touch.
Please take a seat here.
Khatib leads me to a strange-looking metal structure about the size of a basketball with a small black attachment you hold like a pen. It's next to a laptop showing an image of a three-dimensional object.
And you are going to hold this, and this will become the tip of your hand. And with this finger, you're going to go and touch the environment, and now you're going to feel the structure here.
Oh, you can feel it pushing back. That's very, very strange.
So it is virtually your hand inside the computer.
This device allows you to feel the texture and resistance of an object that you can see on a computer screen. The technology could allow a surgeon to operate on a patient in a remote location using robotic arms. The research here focuses on making robots that can physically exist in the human world. Developing robot brains is a separate endeavor. Khatib says eventually the two will be combined.
The truth of the matter is this robot will be capable of cognition, thinking, decision. But I think what is going to happen, like with computers, we are going to become dependent on those machines. And we cannot turn them off because they will have a huge impact on the economy or on other aspects of our life.
He says that doesn't necessarily spell disaster for the human race.
Well, human for all history developed tools, and this is maybe the latest of them. But I don't think it's going to be a competitor to us on our planet. I think it is another advanced tool, but we have to make use of those tools wisely. I think we will be able to live happily with them.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
Today we're talking about artificial intelligence. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Marvin Minsky. He's professor emeritus of media arts and sciences at MIT. He's author of The Emotion Machine, Common Sense Thinking, Artificial Intelligence, and the Future of the Human Mind. Marvin, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. Can you hear me there?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, I can hear you fine. John Perry here. Marvin, you're one of the founders of artificial intelligence. What was your vision for AI in the 1950s and 60s? And in a nutshell, if your vision has changed, how has it changed?
Well, it was to make machines that could do all the kinds of things that humans could or more. And this started just about the same time that computers became available to researchers all over the world. The first computers were in 1950, and there were only a couple of them. But by 1960, there were lots of them. And the interesting thing was that in the very first few years, we were able to make machines that did as well as an MIT student at calculus. And that seemed very promising. In fact, they solved problems at about the same rate that our students did. Of course, that was just a coincidence. Computers are now about a million times faster. So it was easy to do things that people considered hard, but no computer could read a children's storybook or carry on the simplest conversation. So the strange thing is that our field evolved backwards. It started by, it was easy to make computer programs that could do things that people thought were very hard, but it was very hard to make programs that did the kinds of things that even a child can do. So, and it's still that way.
Marvin, that's interesting. That's the Kreisel's remark that John mentioned earlier on in the show. But that's very interesting. I want to think, why is that? What does that reveal about either AI or the human mind or whatever, that these things like calculus and theorem proving turned out to be easy to program, and these things that human beings are so adept at turn out to be so hard to program? What does that reveal about either the limits of computers or the nature of the human mind, in your view?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for these, but the most important one is that I should interrupt myself. I don't use the word intelligence because I think intelligence is a sort of social relationship. You say that someone's intelligent if they do something that you wish you could do, and in the rare case that they can tell you how they did it, you say, oh, I see, that's just a skill.
Okay, so what word would you rather use rather than intelligence?
Well, I like resourcefulness because that characterizes the situation. Jim Slagle's 1961 program that did calculus could only do certain kinds of problems in calculus, but it couldn't play chess and so forth. Then shortly after that, we had programs that played good games of chess, but they couldn't do calculus.
Okay, resourcefulness. You like resourcefulness better than intelligence. So I still want to know what the fact that we could do this one kind of thing, chess, logic solving, calculus. You guys figured out how to do that quickly and how to do it as well or better than an MIT student. But carrying on a simple conversation, that's still a tough nut to crack. What does that reveal about the resources of the human mind versus the resources of computers?
Well, the basic idea in my new book is that instead of trying to find, like a physicist might, what are the laws of thought and how do people think, my idea is that it's 400 million years since we were fish, and in that period, our brains kept evolving, and we found different ways to think, different ways to do things. And so the great thing about a person is a person never gets stuck. If I can't solve a problem, I can think of 10 different ways to try, and if those don't work, I have a lot of other resources. In the most extreme case, I could go and read a book. I could go back to school. I could ask someone else for help.
Let's take a single example here. Chess is now something that computers can do quite well, beating champions and things like that. Does a computer play chess in anything like the way a human plays chess? And if so, what are the major differences?
The way computers play chess today is very different from what humans do. The fact is that even a $500 desktop computer can do operations at about a billion steps per second. And so what most of the chess players now do is they look ahead at each position. You can think of maybe 20 moves, and for each of those, 20 more, so that's 400. And if you look ahead 5 or 10 steps, well, 5 is you might be looking at almost a million positions, and 10, you'd be looking at a trillion. Well, that's about what the present computers do. A person only looks at 4 or 5 positions and analyzes them strategically. That is, they say, well, if I could get my rook up to here, that would stop those pawns from advancing or whatever. And none of the chess programs today do that kind of common sense thinking. They only do exhaustive search, as we call it.
Right. So in a way, they've got more of one kind of capacity, but we're much better at sort of intuition and something. But we'll have to dig into that a little bit deeper after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing artificial intelligence with our guest, Marvin Minsky from MIT. In the 1950s and 60s, he helped start the movement toward real-life AI.
So far on the program, we've talked about what AI hopes to do. Next, we're going to look at how well it does it. What are AI successes? Now, you all interact with AI systems every day when you call on the phone and an artificial system takes you through a bunch of options, maybe in lots of other ways. So what are your frustrations with AI and what impresses you most about it? Join us by calling toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
The current realities and future promise of AI, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
The modern world of robots and AI on Philosophy Talk. Who's your favorite robot, real or science fiction? If you had a robot, what would you want that robot to be like? What would you want it to do? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Tell us your thoughts. The toll-free number, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is one of the founders of artificial intelligence, Marvin Minsky from MIT.
So, Marvin, I want you to give me a sense of the current state of artificial intelligence. I mean, you say in the early days you couldn't get a robot, a computer, to talk as well as a five-year-old to conduct a conversation. Are things any better off now? I mean, has AI made big advances? And what's your favorite big advance?
Well, there were a lot of advances up to about 1980. In getting computers to do all sorts of specialized things. But when it came to the kinds of things that children do or ordinary people, the kind of common sense knowledge and reasoning that people have, that was a terrible obstacle, and no one was able to make a machine that could read a story and answer questions about it. The reason is very simple. To understand things in the world, you have to know a lot of things. That's called common sense. And probably a child knows 20 or 50 million little things about the world. For example, if you saw someone get an umbrella, you ask a child, why is that? And the child will say, well, I think he thinks it might rain. And you say, so what? And the child says, well, he doesn't want to get wet. And you could say, well, how will the umbrella help? And if the child is very articulate, it'll say, oh, it can put the umbrella between the stream of water coming down in your head. And then you say, but why doesn't a person want to get wet? And the child will say, well, it gets your clothes to stick to you and it's sort of creepy. And then you'd say, well, how come people take showers and go swimming and baths? And
I heard an illustration from a philosopher, Bar Hillel, about that once a long time ago. He said, look, take a simple sentence like put the baby in the pen. Any child knows that what you mean is put the baby in the playpen. But a computer will say, well, does that mean stuff the baby in the fountain pen or incarcerate the baby or what? Now, I think that problem's solved now, but I'm not sure that the computers that would understand that sentence understand it. Use the same procedures as humans do. What's the progress on natural language understanding?
Let me add to this, because both Marvin and John, you're making a great point. But here's the thing about all that knowledge that the kid has: nobody actually had to sit down and explicitly tell the kid, okay, all that stuff. I mean, some of the stuff it had to be told, like what an umbrella is. Mm-hmm. This is an umbrella. But all the rest of that reasoning that you had the kid do, Marvin, he never had to be explicitly taught that, right? So tell us more about how much progress we've made toward doing the things with robots and AI that kids can just do kind of automatically.
Well, there were several attempts to make machines that could learn in different ways, and these are wonderful, but there's a little trouble with them. For example, some people said, if all sentences were expressed in perfect logic, then it would be very easy to build a logical inference machine or engine, and these exist. And so you put in a bunch of assumptions, and assuming the words are unambiguous and clear, unlike that pen word, then the machine can grind out all sorts of possible conclusions. But that isn't the way we solve problems. I think we use logic after we solve the problem. I think the most important thing is reasoning by analogy, where you're faced with a situation and you say, this reminds me of another situation, which is like this in some respects and not others. How can I adjust for those differences and use what I learned then? So one way to do that is to build a statistics collecting machine. Another way is to build a sort of evolutionary system which tries little experiments and remembers which work and so forth. And my view is that in the 400 million years in which our brains evolved, we've collected about 20 different ways to think and about 5 different ways to learn, 5 different ways to do reasoning and so forth. And so it's not like the problem in physics to find the 3 laws of motion that Newton
found. We're not
found.
Looking for just one formula that will take care of learning and everything. What would you say to a philosopher who said, but look, you've got a more basic problem. Your machines aren't conscious, and they don't have intentionality. You have somebody back at your lab worried about getting those things into machines?
Well, chapter 4 of my book is called Consciousness, and it says that there's a funny thing here. The word consciousness is our word that we use as an excuse to not think about the 20 different ways that we keep track of things. For example, when you're thinking, you're remembering what you've thought before so you don't get in loops. So you're using your recent memory, and that's part of consciousness. Another aspect of consciousness is that you're making a model of yourself, and you're saying, look, I've tried this and that. Maybe I'm not suited for this kind of problem, or maybe I should change my personality a little bit and turn into, switch from mathematics to art. Everybody has 10 different personalities, or maybe 50. And what we call consciousness, I think, is just a word for, I think I list 24 different kinds of processes for which we use that very same word.
We're talking to Marvin Minsky, and the book he's mentioning is The Emotion Machine, a very fascinating book. I don't know if he has the whole truth about consciousness, but he's got some very good ideas.
And we want to hear your ideas on this topic. We're talking about artificial intelligence and what it can achieve, has achieved, will or won't achieve. The number to join this conversation, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or comments at philosophytalk.org for email. Bill in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bill.
Hi. From the 50s until about the 80s, I guess it was predicted that next Tuesday that there would be a machine that could pass the Turing test, and it didn't happen. So some of the enthusiasm after the 80s, I think it no longer was considered imminent. And so my question has to do with basically some of the computational approaches people use. Is the representation of knowledge, have we new methodologies of knowledge representation since the 80s, or were we still working with logic and semantic networks and frames, do we feel that we have an adequate technology to represent knowledge now to go forward with AI, or are more fundamental developments needed?
Well, before turning that over to our guests, I think we should clarify some of those ideas. Now, the Turing test, that's from Alan Turing, a philosopher, a logician who also played an extremely important role in the beginning of computer science as a mathematical and really scientific discipline. And his idea was that you could say you had intelligence in a computer if it would be difficult for a person to tell whether they were talking to if the computer could fool a third person, who of course couldn't look at it but was just getting a typescript of what it said, as to whether it was a human or a computer. Now, my understanding is it turns out to be a lot easier to fool people than maybe Turing realized, but we should see what...
Well, they have an annual prize, I think, the Loebner Prize, for whether you can pass the Turing test. I don't think anything's actually done it yet, right? Because it's a pretty hard test, the Turing test. And the knowledge representation, Marvin, why don't you explain what the caller meant by knowledge representation?
I think that's the important thing. In the early days of artificial intelligence, and still in most laboratories, people say, what's the best way to represent knowledge so a computer can use it? And some people say, let's use logic and logical statements. But to me, that's not very good, because logic is a strange language. It has only 2 adjectives, always and sometimes, and never. So it's hard to express analogies with logic. And another way to represent knowledge, which we're emphasizing, is why not use ordinary natural language sentences? Because most of the ambiguities in natural language are good, not bad. If you use a certain word, it has several shades of meaning. And I believe one of the most important ways to think is you describe the situation to yourself in words, and then you misunderstand it and interpret it another way. So there are all sorts of technical ways to represent knowledge, things called frames and transframes and scripts and certainly stories in natural language and what we don't have time to discuss semantic nets, but those are collections of objects that are linked by various relationships. And the important thing, I think, is that a human has 400 different areas of the brain that we can identify, and I'll bet that we have 8 or 10 different ways to represent knowledge. So then if one of them doesn't work, we just switch to another, and that's why people are so resourceful. We have many ways to do each thing.
We have a caller who has a question about the computer's ability to learn from their mistakes, I think. Martine in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Martine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I understand that, you know, most of one of the fundamental ways we learn is by mistakes, trial and error. I just want to ask, whether is it the same approach that the artificial intelligence people do, that they basically try to create machines which learn from their mistakes or make mistakes in order to learn, or is it a completely different approach?
Our listener has a very important point, because in most of computer science, people use rule-based systems where they say, if this situation occurs, do that, and if this happens, do that. But learning from mistakes is very important. You know that you can pull things with a string, but you can't push them, and every child learns that. And I suspect that maybe a good deal more than half of common sense knowledge is learning what not to do, and that saves you a tremendous amount of time. If you look at those great chess-playing programs, 100 million possible moves are explored, and then one is taken. The others were wasted. A smart chess player already knows how to recognize patterns where there's no point in moving that rook.
Marvin, I understand that. I think you're right that we do a lot of learning from mistakes, but I wouldn't overestimate, because we do a lot of also one-shot learning. Somebody tells me a fact, and all this other stuff pops out, right? I mean, somebody shows me what an umbrella is and what it's for, and then all that reasoning that you talked about the kid being able to engage in kind of automatically is there. Just add one fact, you know, umbrellas are these shaped things that will keep the water off you. Oh, people can use these when they don't want to get wet. Oh, people can, right? There's not learning from mistake there, right?
Well, I think there's something very important that I don't see in modern psychological theories. Namely, when something happens, you're going to store a sort of script or a representation or image or whatever of it. So we know that we remember things in various ways. What I believe happens is that when you have an experience, there's no use just storing a story about it away unless you link it to things. And so you have to remember, what kind of problem was I solving when this fact turned out to be useful or useless? And so each fragment of knowledge, as you learn it, and maybe this happens while you sleep, because you know long-term memory takes many hours, not seconds. I think we build very clever structures each time we learn something and unconsciously link it to other similar things and notice the differences and which similarities are relevant. And, you know, if you assemble an object, you don't care whether it's on a weekend or a day.
Marvin, we're getting quite a bit of email, and let me run through a little bit of it. Michael wonders whether we could get a philosophy test passing computer. I think that raises the interesting question whether philosophy is something humans do well or something humans do poorly.
Yeah, we've been at it for what, thousands of years, and how many problems have we solved?
Yeah, we haven't solved any problems yet. We better let the computers take over.
But philosophy explores the things that we don't understand, and it's the start of sciences.
That's so good. That's good.
Well spoken, Marvin.
And Alex and Paul are both, and now you, you might think AI is this kind of sober part of science where people sit around big tables and let computers solve their controversies, but actually there have been a lot of controversies in AI. You've made some criticisms of the logic-based approach, and I know that can be a very emotional issue, but Alex and Paul are both interested in your reaction to the work of Hubert Dreyfus and his complaints about the vision and possibilities of AI.
Well, tell us what those complaints are, John.
Well, Dreyfus comes from a Heideggerian approach, which means I don't really understand it. Hubert Dreyfus at UC Berkeley, this is from Paul, wrote a famous book, What Computers Can't Do, in which he lists a number of things that AI will never be able to do no matter how powerful the computer.
One of them was, for example, conduct a conversation as well as a five-year-old, Marvin. I mean, Dreyfus a long time ago was arguing, this logic-chomping stuff is too simple. Human minds are much more complex, much more attuned to the environment. They have all this knowledge in there that they effortlessly...
Well, sounds like Marvin agrees with that.
Yeah, do you agree with that? Do you agree with the Dreyfus approach?
I agree that when Dreyfus wrote those criticisms some 30 years ago, they were sort of right. But the idea that we'll never make any progress is silly. And I think if he read my book, he would agree with most of it today and maybe change some of his. But you can get him on the program. He's still alive and active and smart.
Yeah. Well, John Searle, Dreyfus's colleague, Berkeley is a center. The Berkeley philosophy is the center of anti-AI. John Searle, Dreyfus's colleague, has a different kind of thing. He says computation is the wrong kind of thing. It's just pushing around symbols. And thought and thinking and reasoning is more than that. I don't quite know what he thinks the more is. It's something the brain does uniquely, and a symbol-pushing computer is just syntax. Couldn't possibly think and reason and understand. What do you think about that Searle kind of line?
I think you should read my book again. And he hasn't responded to many criticisms, and it sounds like a sort of religious thing. He thinks there's a spirit or a soul or something. Maybe I'm bad-mouthing him, but none of those criticisms make any sense. How does he know you can't make a machine that has even better semantic relations between symbols and things in the world?
It's just a matter of progress.
Maybe what he says is true of fish.
Okay, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing artificial intelligence with one of its founders, Marvin Minsky from MIT.
Do you think it would be a good thing if computers could write songs and symphonies, poems and novels as well as humans do? Or is this just one more way in which science is figuring out how to undermine human dignity and make us second-class citizens in our own world?
Next, we'll take up some moral questions facing artificial intelligence when Philosophy Talk continues.
Okay, what about robot girlfriends? Would it be morally okay if your girlfriend was a robot? What if it was a more intelligent robot than the one in the song, one that could carry on conversations and was clever? Would it be morally okay to just take out her batteries when she got irritating or mad at you? Moral questions seem to be right over the horizon in artificial intelligence. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Right now we're questioning some moral issues raised by AI or the progress of AI with our guest, Marvin Minsky. Marvin, I've been reading your book. Actually, I'm about halfway through it, The Emotion Machine. I think it's a really fine and interesting book. And there's something fundamental I agree with you about. It seems to me that we have to really do a lot more understanding of the nature of human thought and consciousness and the self and common sense reasoning and all that, right, before we can hope to make progress in AI. That you call these suitcase words that hide more than they reveal. I think you're right about that. But I want to give you a pretend. Pretend we understand everything about human consciousness and human selfhood and human common sense and all that, and pretend that AI advances to some future state in which we can implement all these things in a computer and understand how that's done. I'm going to think about the moral universe that we would then have created. I mean, how should we think about these artificially intelligent creations? Is just another moral agent among others, another moral patient? Help me to think about that a bit. What's your first reaction?
Well, first reaction is that there's a nice question of, is it all right to turn your computer off? Mm-hmm. And everybody thinks it is. But it's partly because you can turn it back on again and it will reboot. It's not all right to turn a person off because that person has a lifetime of knowledge and experience, and you know, everyone is valuable. You don't need to take a philosophical position. A normal middle-aged person is worth several million dollars in productivity for society, and so it's bad to do bad things to them. To me, the strange moral issue is that we're willing to let people die. It's not so much a matter of robots. I think with you can't predict how long it'll take, we will be able to download and make backup copies of human minds.
Yeah.
And then you'll store these away. Of course, the population problem is serious. In 100 years, I think people will be living 200 or 300 years, and the planet will be filled with too many old people. Zero population growth won't help.
You're right. I mean, these are real problems, right? And I wonder about populating the world with even more moral agents who are synthetic, artificial, and maybe who will last forever. But I want to make this a little bit harder for you. I mean, it seems to me, first of all, you know, we might be able to get consciousness and something like the ability to reason and engage in common sense reasoning and all that, carry on ordinary conversations without getting a moral sense in there, right? And if we get these artificially intelligent agents who have goals and purposes but no moral sense, God, isn't that a nightmare thing? Because what will enable us to control these non-moral sense guys? Or do you think a moral sense can be automated?
As far as I can see, there isn't any very clear thing called moral sense or ethical rules. To me, when people talk about ethical rules, they're mostly saying, can I take a very complicated situation and express it as 10 if-then rules, like 10 commandments, into compact form? And these will give you guidelines for how you should act right now, but they don't take into account the long-term consequences. And
Just if-then, it's also sympathy and fellow feeling. I see another creature and I feel its suffering, and because I feel its suffering, I don't do certain things to it. Do you think we can do that for robots? Can we get emotions and sympathy and fellow feeling programmed into them?
Well, to me, emotions are just different ways to think, and there's nothing special about them. Let's take suffering. That's chapter 3. How come some people like to climb a mountain and their fingers are bleeding and they're in terrible pain and they're enjoying it tremendously? So we don't want to eliminate suffering. We want to eliminate useless suffering and chronic pain. But the struggle and the unpleasantness and the joy of discovering things is enjoying being wrong and making mistakes so you can correct them and growing. Suffering is a wonderful thing in that sense.
But why do we, not in the sense of people who are curious like yourself and invested in AI, but why do we, the public in general, the taxpayers, why do we want to do any of this? Isn't the world okay as it is? Why do we need, if we're going to be overpopulated amongst ourselves, why do we need lots of other sophisticated human-like machines? Can't we just use computers the way we use them and leave them at that?
Well, first, we're going to have an aging population and there won't be any workers. So we have to build robots just to clean the streets and babysit and make the beds, because you'll have a 300-year-old adult with a 150-year-old child.
Well, it might be easier to build artificial intelligent robots that could do all that than to solve the immigration problem. But sorry to interrupt you.
So you were saying...
I think we have to solve the immigration problem, because each culture doesn't want to be diluted and dissipated by the other cultures. It's a perfectly reasonable thing if you think of the culture itself as a big fat person as opposed to the individual. So there's natural selection and evolution on that level, too.
Let me try it out a different way. Suppose, John, we've been talking about the kind of budget of capacities, the whole package of capacities that go into human intelligence and cognition and emotion and all that. It's a whole budget of things. But, you know, it looks like maybe, especially given the way you write about this in your book, The Emotion Machine, that maybe you don't have to have all of them at once. So suppose we could build a robot that was, you know, a good babysitter. I mean, right now, with a human being, you get all or nothing kind of thing, right? You get the whole package. But, you know, we could design robots that maybe were intelligent and rational calculators, but didn't care at all about themselves, had no feeling about themselves. And then we could do whatever we want because there would be kind of no suffering that they might have. I mean, what about that?
I think that's right. And John McCarthy at Stanford wrote a couple of papers about it. I should tell our listeners that if they search Google for Marvin Minsky, you'll find a lot of essays about these sorts of things, and similarly for John McCarthy at Stanford, who discusses some of these. It should be possible to build robots that are morally handicapped. It might be a little dangerous if they're also very smart, but I think the philosophers of the near future are going to have to deal with that.
Well, wait a minute. So tell me what you think. So morally handicapped in two ways. They could be morally handicapped as moral agents, right? They could do awful things, and we wouldn't want that. But they could also be morally handicapped as moral patients. That is, we could do awful things to them, and they wouldn't mind. Why wouldn't we want that? Why wouldn't we want a class of like slave-like robots who didn't have any desire for freedom, but they were highly intelligent and effective?
That's a great engineering question. Can you make a machine very smart if you don't give it the ability to reflect on what it's done and what were its goals and so forth? And it might be very difficult to make a really smart robot that doesn't build a model of itself and build value systems, because it's got so many choices to make, it needs some way to make them. So it might be tough, but on the other hand, there might be an elegant solution.
What I'd like to see us do in this field is make not necessarily robots, but computer systems that are moral resources. That is, I think it'd be lovely if every time the president had a major decision to make or Congress, there was some very sophisticatedly, constantly updated artificial intelligence system that could use the best knowledge available and the best reasoning available and spit out some answers about what it thinks the probabilities are and so forth. You wouldn't put the decision-making capability in its hand, but you'd say you'd at least get its presumably objective, dispassionate, and disinterested viewpoint, which is sometimes very hard to come by when you're just dealing with human beings.
Sure, but I wouldn't call this moral or ethics. I'd say whenever you have a choice to make, it would be nice if you could look ahead and see how it will affect the world, and then you need a set of ways to decide which of those is desirable or not. And it's hard to trust anyone to make up a set of such laws because, you know, most moral principles lead to wars and devastation of one kind or another.
Plus, if you take some recent work in neuroscience by Damasio, right, if you kind of don't have the affective side, the emotional side, then you can't make good practical judgments because, you know, when your emotions are toned down, when you don't have them, nothing matters to you. So we got to make things matter to these robots, to these calculators. And if we don't get the emotions in there, we won't get the mattering. So I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think we need a mechanical theory of what goals and purposes are. And we have one developed by Alan Newell and Herbert Simon in the 1960s. And that's the one I use in this book. I don't see that it's a matter of ethics. I think what Damasio talks about in his books are situations where a person can't change their ways to think, and so they get stuck. And you could call that emotional, but I call it a damage to the system that helps a person switch when they're stuck to another state. I just see emotions as not different from thinking, but each emotional state is a particular way to think. And sitting down and crying is a way to get other people to help you solve your problem.
Definitely. So, look, a robot that had no emotions might be a kind of thinker, but it wouldn't be a human-like thinker. But if they were among us, I just think it would be a nightmare. Machines that could think but couldn't feel would be a moral nightmare. But we don't really have time to dig into that nightmare. And Marvin, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us.
Okay. It's been great to be here. And send me email if you have any more questions.
Okay. Our guest has been Marvin Minsky, Professor Emeritus of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT, author of The Emotion Machine, Common Sense Thinking, Artificial Intelligence, and the Future of the Human Mind. So, John, what did you learn today?
Well, you know, I have a view about AI. AI is a discipline that has really grown up in the sense of being an alternative available to students in college and graduate school since the 60s. And I think a lot of I sometimes think of philosophy as a device for keeping genes that are relatively useless for other purposes in the gene pool, and then something comes along and they're useful all of a sudden. A lot of people who would have become philosophers in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, by the 80s and late 70s, were becoming AI. So I've always had a lot of friends in AI, had philosophers that go into AI. I think it's a great discipline. But I fear, like all parts of science, it's going to plunge ahead with its curiosity without thinking about the complications it's going to foist upon the world. But that's just my kind of pessimistic outlook.
Well, you know, I think you and I must share our pessimism. I mean, AI did get stuck for a while, and I do think there are some advances happening because people are learning much more about how this complicated brain in our heads work, and they're using that knowledge to make some advances. But you know what? Once you unlock that knot, all these possibilities open up of kind of debased moral agents and all this stuff. And I do think there's a nightmare scenario there. I really do.
Yeah, but I think there's another more optimistic scenario. Think of at the beginning of World War II or after World War II at Versailles or before the Iraq War, if you really had a dispassionate computer that could print out exactly what the facts were, or at least exactly what the options were in probabilities, would have helped a lot.
Yeah, you're right about that. Now, unlike androids or robots, real people face moral dilemmas all the time and philosophical conundrums all the time, John.
Do you have a conundrum, a question that's making you scratch your head?
Let us know about it, and we'll help you think about the issue in a philosophical manner.
How do you do that? You visit philosophytalk.org, and you look for the conundrum button and give it a poke.
Our cyber secretary will take your information, and maybe we can help you solve your conundrum.
Now, for the final word on AI, we turn to the least artificial intellect of anyone we know, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, back in the late 80s, Hans Moravec, a professor at Carnegie Mellon University's Robotics Institute, wrote a book called Mind Children, The Future of Robot and Human Intelligence. In it, he posited that in 40 years, 2030 or so, computer-controlled robots will achieve human equivalence. Rather than being alarmed by this prospect, Moravec was enthusiastic about it. In fact, at one point, he posited that in the future, humans will become robots themselves. This will be accomplished with the loving aid of robot surgeons. He wrote, quote, layer after layer, the brain is simulated, then excavated. Your suddenly abandoned body goes into spasms and dies. Your perspective has shifted to a shiny new body of the style, color, and material of your choice, unquote. Mind Children earned Moravec a certain amount of fame in the geek world. In an interview with Wired magazine in 1995, he claimed that rather than spelling our doom, robots will take good care of humans, whom he cheerfully called Earth's small-minded biological natives. He told the interviewer, quote, they will in fact be able to recreate a model of our entire civilization, with everything and everyone in it, down to the atomic level, simulating our atoms with machinery that's vastly subatomic. Also, they'll be able to use data compression to remove the redundant stuff that isn't important, unquote. So humans will become semi-robot inhabitants in a robot simulation of human history, kind of like Disneyland without the parking lots. On the anti-artificial intelligence side, Roger Penrose, the British mathematician and physicist, in a review of Mind Children for the New York Review of Books, called Moravec's notions horrific. Penrose insisted, quote, computation does not evoke consciousness. The brain's action involves ingredients that are of an essentially non-computational nature, so that no adequate simulation of the conscious brain's action would be possible using just a computer, unquote. In an effort to prove the non-computational nature of consciousness, Penrose developed by hand what came to be known as Penrose tiling. It's a design of five-fold symmetry that doesn't repeat itself predictably, but forms patterns indefinitely, patterns that cannot be solved algorithmically. In other words, the human brain can make these patterns, but a computer can't. Therefore, the brain cannot be emulated by artificial intelligence. On a final note, Penrose found himself suing the Kimberly-Clark Corporation when it appropriated the Penrose tiling patterns as a decoration for Kleenex quilted bathroom tissue. Well, that part has me convinced that Penrose is right and Moravec is wrong. Toilet paper and lawyers are not things you'll find in a robot world. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Zoe Corneli, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or mis-expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.